From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The discovery that penicillin can kill bacteria revolutionized medicine. Scientists are still trying to find an effective strategy against viruses. Today's science writer Carl Zimmer tells us about some of the most promising research, like attempts to create a synthetic version of a molecule called interferon. It's normally created naturally by cells infected by viruses. Interferons work by doing all sorts of things to fight off viruses.
One of the coolest things that they do is that the interferons actually go out of the infected cell and go to neighboring cells and basically give them the signal, kill yourself. So all of these cells around the infected cell commit suicide, and it's like a fire break, so that any viruses that might get out have nothing to infect.
Also, we talk with the great Dutch jazz drummer Han Benink, who will play drums and just about everything else in our studio. That's on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since the discovery of penicillin in 1928, antibiotics have helped us fight bacterial infections. But scientists are still trying to find ways of effectively fighting viruses. Our guest, science writer Carl Zimmer, writes about efforts to develop new antiviral treatments in the current edition of Wired. As you'll hear, some of the approaches are particularly creative, like encouraging a cell that's been infected by a virus to commit suicide so the virus can't use it to replicate and spread to other cells. Carl Zimmer is a lecturer at Yale University and the author of 12 books, including A Planet of Viruses. He writes a blog called The Loom at Discover.com, and his articles appear in many publications, including The New York Times, National Geographic, Time, and Scientific America. Zimmer spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Carl Zimmer, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's begin with a couple of basics. The difference between bacteria and viruses. How are they different, fundamentally different?
Well, bacteria, believe it or not, are a lot more like us than viruses are. Bacteria are big cells that have DNA in them and protein in them. They can feed, they can grow, they can build their own proteins, and then they can divide. They can live on their own, essentially. Viruses are very different. Most of them are just protein shells with genes inside. Kind of, you can think of them as shells, like little hard balls that go into much bigger cells, and the shells break open, and inside are the genes for the virus. And those genes then essentially take over the cell and start using it to manufacture new viruses. And then they break out of the host cell to go off and infect other host cells, and maybe then you get a bad cough or a runny nose, and you release viruses to go infect somebody else.
Right. Now, the broad-spectrum antibiotics that exist, like penicillin and others, can kill all kinds of bacteria. Do the existing antiviral drugs destroy or attack a lot of different viruses, or are they specifically targeted toward a unique virus?
So there are some really amazing antivirals that have been invented in over the, say, last 40 years. So there are antivirals for herpes, for example. There are antivirals for HIV. Now, if a person is infected with HIV, they can take antivirals that will keep their virus under control. It won't wipe them out, but it will allow someone to have a relatively long, relatively healthy life. Now, if you were to get Ebola, which is caused by a virus, and you tried to take those HIV drugs, they do you no good at all. Because that HIV drug, it only works for HIV. So in other words, it's a narrow-spectrum drug. And really, there are no broad-spectrum antivirals, at least at this point.
Right. And you've written recently about efforts to develop new treatments which will really attack viruses more broadly. There are three of them that you describe in this piece in Wired. Let's take them one at a time. One of them, developed by this scientist and his sister, focuses on what, the external shell of the replicated virus? Explain how this works.
Sure. So this approach was developed by Vishwanath Lingappa and his sister Jayashree Lingappa. And the basic idea behind it is that viruses need help to build themselves. It used to be thought that once a host cell made new copies of virus genes and made new virus proteins, that basically the virus could take it from there, that the molecules would just spontaneously come together and form new viruses. It was called self-assembly. And what the Lingappas showed is that that's actually wrong, that the viruses need a little help. And what happens is quite amazing. They actually somehow get lots of different proteins in our cells to come together and cooperate to sort of push their own proteins into place, like they're putting together a very complicated puzzle. And so the viruses need these groups of host proteins to form.
So how do they stop the virus, all these different viruses?
Well, it seems that a lot of viruses depend on some of the same host proteins to get built. And so if you just create a drug that kind of gets in the way and prevents the viruses from pulling in these host proteins to do these cooperative jobs, you don't get any viruses. And so that also means that this is an approach that might not have very many side effects, because all you're doing is stopping proteins coming together to make new viruses. That's it.
So we could take a medication that would enter our healthy cells, wouldn't damage the cells, but would somehow prevent the proteins in them from helping a virus to get in and replicate?
That's right. Once the virus was in and was trying to use your cell to make new viruses, this drug would just step in and just stop that little manipulation. And that would be it. And that's enough, apparently, to stop viruses. And, for example, Lingapa has worked with army researchers on an animal test on Ebola. And so what they did was inject mice with Ebola virus. And if the mice were not protected, in 10 days, they were all dead. Then what they did was injected one of these drugs that Lingapa's discovered into another group of mice once a day for four days, and they got 100% protection. So you have all dead mice and all living mice. And so, you know, again, these are preliminary results, but they're very promising.
There's a second approach that you write about in which some other researchers are dealing with interferons, ways that our body naturally attack viruses. You want to explain how they work?
Yeah. So like the Lingapas, other scientists want to figure out how to use our own bodies to kill viruses. And actually, our own bodies are killing viruses all the time. And one of the most important ways that they do it is with a molecule called interferon. So what happens when you get infected, when a virus comes into a cell, is very often there's a protein in your cell that can recognize, say, a virus protein or a virus gene. And it essentially sets off an alarm in your cell. And the cell makes this wonderful protein called interferon. And interferon then does all sorts of things to fight off the virus. It basically switches on about 300 genes in the cell, and they do all sorts of different things. One of the things that they do is they cut up virus DNA. So any virus genes that are floating around get sliced up into bits so that they're useless. Another thing that interferon does is it stiffens the wall of the cell where the viruses are so that the viruses can't get out. And then finally, one of the coolest things that they do is that the interferons actually go out of the infected cell and go to neighboring cells and basically give them a signal and say, kill yourself. So all of these cells around the infected cell commit suicide, and it's like a fire break so that any viruses that might get out have nothing to infect.
Okay, and one of the key researchers here is Eleanor Fish, right? What has she managed to do?
So Eleanor Fish at the University of Toronto is in charge of a program called the International Consortium of Antivirals. And what they would like to do is they would actually like to create a synthetic interferon. So an interferon that you could take, you know, as a pill or an injection or so on. And actually, this is part of a long-running line of research on interferon. People discovered interferon in the 1950s, and it was so amazing that they thought that they had actually discovered the key to fighting viruses and that this would be kind of like a penicillin. It's been very difficult to live up to that dream. Today, people with hepatitis C can get interferon treatment, but it doesn't work all that well. I mean, it has some benefit, but it's not as good as Eleanor Fish would like. And so what she's been doing is she has been essentially tweaking the interferon molecule to make it more effective, to make it last longer, to make it safe, and to make it cheap. Because what she wants to do is to be able to deploy interferon, you know, all over the world in very poor parts of the world where there isn't fancy refrigeration. She wants to be able to help people who are dealing with viruses in very remote places.
There's another fascinating approach to fighting viruses that you describe in this piece, and it involves, well, what? Cell suicide?
That's right. This is an approach that is probably the most radical of the three that I talk about in the article, because It really involves just making a molecule from scratch that manipulates our bodies in a totally new way. It's the work of someone named Todd Ryder, who works at MIT. And Todd got the idea for this while he was developing a biowarfare type detection machine, essentially a machine that you would set up like in government buildings to detect if someone had released anthrax or some other kind of agent. And it occurred to Ryder that, you know, if they detected anthrax, they could do something about it. You could give people antibiotics. But if it was, say, for example, smallpox, there's really nothing you can do. There's no antiviral for smallpox. And the idea he got was that, you know, our cells, you know, they can recognize viruses when they come in because viruses have special kinds of genetic material. And so what he did was he fashioned a molecule that could latch on to that genetic material. And on the other end of this molecule, it could essentially act as a switch to switch on genes that would cause the cell to kill itself. So as soon as a virus infects a cell, the cell kills itself, the virus can't replicate, we're done.
And how do you get a cell to kill itself?
Well, you know, actually our cells have a bunch of genes in them that are just about suicide. Actually, it's very important for your cells to be able to kill themselves. And the reason is that, you know, every now and then you might get a mutation that might cause your cell to start growing and dividing too fast. In other words, to become cancerous. So if that happens, you need a way to stop it. And so one of the ways to stop it is to switch on this program for cell suicide. And there are actually other situations where it's beneficial for your body, just in the normal business of living your life, for your cells to kill themselves. And so what Todd Ryder is doing is exploiting that. He's basically kind of hotwiring your cells so that as soon as they get infected by a virus, that trips the switch. This doesn't exist naturally, but if you were to take a pill, the thinking is, then this molecule would go into your infected cells, and as soon as they detected the virus, they would kill those infected cells, and you would recover from your disease.
We're speaking with science writer Carl Zimmer. He's written recently in Wired about some innovative strategies to fight viruses. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Carl Zimmer. He's a science writer who has an article in the current edition of Wired about innovative efforts to fight viruses. His book, A Planet of Viruses, will be out soon in paperback. If we did have, you know, drugs which allowed us to attack viruses in our bodies, all kinds of viruses, is there any risk that we could attack viruses that might be helpful to us?
That's a possibility. And it's pretty amazing that, you know, we can even talk about that. I mean, that's one of the really interesting things about these new results. I mean, these scientists are getting real broad spectrum effects. They can wipe out lots of different viruses. And so it does raise an intriguing question. Do you want to wipe out all viruses? And you know, I think antibiotics, you know, teach us a kind of cautionary lesson here. Because, you know, antibiotics, when you take them, you wipe out the bacteria that's making you sick, but you actually also wipe out a lot of bacteria that you depend on for your health. And, you know, eventually your body may recover, but it can take a while, and there might actually be some bad consequences of the antibiotics themselves. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the future if we are, in fact, you know, knocking out lots of viruses, because we really don't understand sort of the full ecology of the viruses that get into our bodies. Some are harmful. Some may not be harmful. Some may actually help us to defend against other viruses. It's very complicated in there, and we don't really understand it very well yet.
You said there are bacteria that contribute to our health?
Absolutely. So you and I and everybody else, we each have about 100 trillion bacteria in our bodies. We only have 10 trillion cells, human cells. So, you know, we're 10 to 1 bacteria. They cover our skin. They line our mouths. They're in our lungs. They're in our stomachs and our intestines. They're everywhere. And in a lot of those places, they seem to be doing some very important things. So in our guts, for example, they make vitamins. They actually create a kind of defensive wall that keeps out the bacteria that would make us sick. And they even teach our immune system to behave properly. And if you don't have a healthy gut flora, you can actually end up growing up with and developing asthma or allergies. There's been some connections between these bacteria and how well our immune system works when we grow up.
Do we know if there are viruses that are helpful to us as well?
Well, there are certainly viruses that attack those bacteria. In fact, each of us has about 4 trillion of those viruses, which are called phages. Now, they don't care about us. They can't infect our cells. They're going after the bacteria. And they might be kind of like the lions of our inner ecosystem. And so they're keeping different prey species in check. And so maybe our health depends on those viruses that are attacking those bacteria. It's also possible that there are viruses that infect human cells that are, you know, either not having any effect on us, they're just sort of neutral, or perhaps even helping us in some way we don't understand. I mean, scientists are finding that in other animals, there are some beneficial viruses, so it's possible.
We have 4 trillion viruses or 4 trillion different kinds of viruses?
We have 4 trillion viruses, if you just count them one by one. Nobody can quite say how many species they are, but it would probably be in the hundreds of species of viruses. We might have 1,000 or more species of bacteria in our bodies.
So these microbes, these microscopic organisms, bacteria, they're everywhere in our bodies. Do they live in colonies? Or do they function together in groups?
So these bacteria probably live mostly in films. Actually, they create these films themselves. They will produce lots of sticky molecules that glue themselves together. And so you'll have these layers of bacteria lining your teeth, lining your throat, lining your lungs, lining your gut, lining your skin too. And they are sitting there feeding off of the food that you take in or whatever nutrients they can come across. And then some of them will actually feed on the waste of other species. And so you will have bacteria of lots of different species in these biofilms. And in a lot of cases, they're going to be cooperating across the species barrier.
The rainforest in the fold of my thumb, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely. Like, you know, you could think about the sharks that have the remora fish stuck on them, and then the remora feed on the bits of food that the sharks don't eat. Well, there are bacteria that do exactly that, that where one species takes the waste of another species and feeds on that, and they produce waste that another species feeds on. And then guess what? When you finally get down to that end of that chain of breaking down food into waste, we eat what they leave behind.
Ourselves.
That's right. So especially when it comes to tough plant matter, we can't eat it. We actually depend on our bacteria to help break it down. And once they've taken apart these molecules into smaller sugars, then we can feed on them because we just don't have the enzymes that bacteria have. We don't have the genetic versatility that bacteria have. And if you think about it, if there are perhaps 1,000 species, who knows, maybe 2,000 species of bacteria in our bodies, and each one of those species has, say, a couple thousand genes, you're talking about a collective genome that dwarfs the human genome and might be 100 times bigger. So if you were to grind up our bodies and just count out all the genes, it would be 1% human genes and maybe 99% microbe genes. And so we're sort of a super organism.
Now, if there are many times as many microbes as there are human cells, do they compare in mass and volume? I mean, are the human cells bigger?
Human cells are maybe 10 or 100 times bigger than bacteria. So if you took all the bacteria in our bodies and kind of just molded them together, you would have about 3 or 4 pounds of biomass. And you can think of that as like an organ, like your heart or your brain. So you've got this 3 or 4 pound organ in your body that we call the microbiome. But instead of being one big mass of cells, it's diffused out throughout your entire body.
These are microscopic organisms. They include bacteria and other things. Is that right?
So we've got bacteria in us. We've got viruses. We've got fungi. We've got other kinds of microbes that are called archaea and protozoans. We've got a whole zoo in there. And this is when we're perfectly healthy. These are not things that are making us sick. In fact, if you took all these things out of us, we would probably get sick very quickly because the pathogens would be able to come in and take over.
Science writer Carl Zimmer will continue his conversation with Dave Davies in the second half of the show. Zimmer's article about research into antiviral drugs is in the current edition of Wired. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback. Angie'sList.com. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting leadership, innovation, and collaboration for a better New Jersey. More at grdodge.org. And from Subaru, introducing the all-new Subaru Impreza. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. This is NPR.
The great Dutch jazz drummer Han Bennink celebrates his 70th birthday today. Coming up, he brings a drum and his sticks and turns just about everything in our studio into percussion instruments. Also, more with science writer Carl Zimmer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview that Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with science writer Carl Zimmer, who's been writing about how bacteria and viruses attack our body and strategies to fight them. His article about research into new antiviral drugs is in the current edition of Wired.
You've written recently about microbes in the body and the fascinating ways that they may harm us, help us, and define us. And there's a fascinating case in 2008 of a woman in Minnesota who was severely ill with some, I guess, gastrointestinal infection. You want to explain what was going on with her? What happened?
Sure. So this was a woman who had taken antibiotics for a lung infection. and the antibiotics worked. They got rid of the lung infection. And unfortunately, they killed off a lot of good bacteria in her intestines, allowing bad bacteria, in this case, a species called Clostridium difficile, to take over and to cause a very serious infection. This caused massive diarrhea, and she was losing weight practically every day. She had lost 60 pounds in a matter of a couple months. The bacteria was resistant to all antibiotics. And so her doctor, Alexander Koritz at the University of Minnesota, really was kind of at its wit's end. I mean, there was not much else that he could do, and you know, she was probably going to die very soon. And so what he decided to do was try out an experimental technique that people have tried from time to time in different parts of the world. The thinking is that if you can restore the ecology of a person's body, then that ecology will make these bad bacteria go away. And the way that he did this is that he performed what's called a fecal transplant. And what that means is that he took a small stool sample from her husband and diluted it and then gave it to her kind of like as a suppository. There are bacteria in that sample then colonized her intestines. And literally 2 days later, she started feeling better. And a couple weeks later, when they went to sample the bacteria that were there, they couldn't find the C. difficile anymore. It was just gone.
The harmful bacteria, right, yeah.
Right, so they couldn't find the harmful bacteria anymore. It had just disappeared. And the only thing they had done is that they had essentially restored her ecology, kind of like restoring a wetlands.
So the theory is that the treatment for the lung problem had kind of upset the ecological balance there by killing certain bacteria she needed, and this harmful bacteria flourished. And then by introducing microbes from her husband's intestine, the ecology was restored and the harmful bacteria was taken out.
That's right. I mean, actually, there are a lot of parallels with kind of ecology that we think of, you know, when we're thinking of, say, lakes and prairies and so on. And it's well known that in an ecology that's been fragmented and degraded and lost a lot of species, it's easy for invasive species to come in. It's actually easier for them to come in to these degraded ecosystems than healthy ones. And so this woman, by taking antibiotics, had actually degraded her ecosystem, her microbiome, these microbes, so that they couldn't create a kind of defensive wall to keep out the bad bacteria like Clostridium difficile. And so by restoring these species that had been kind of pushed out after a while, they were able to create a kind of an ecosystem that could fight against the bad bacteria and make it harder for that to replicate.
And how much do we understand about how these microbes interact?
We know next to nothing about how these microbes interact. This is one of the frontiers of biology, I think, because we don't even have really a good catalog of all the species that are in us. And so, you know, you and I probably have kind of an overlapping catalog of microbes that are in us, but they're not the same. And, you know, if the person next to you would have, if you looked at their catalog, they would have a somewhat different one. And nobody quite knows why we have these different species and different levels and so on. But they've got to be doing something. And the fact is that bacteria are incredibly, incredibly cooperative. Very often, one species cannot survive without several other species because they work together. They break down compounds together and share them. And so there's this whole ecosystem of interactions that's going on inside our own bodies that we do not understand barely at all. Scientists are just starting to figure it out with very big projects where they're sequencing all the genes that these microbes have. But they're just at the very beginning of understanding it.
And you're right that different parts of the body will have different kind of combinations of microbes, that in that even different sides of a tooth will have a different combination of species.
That's right. It seems like the microbes are carving us up into incredibly fine niches. And so, yeah, different sizes of your teeth are different ecological niches for the bacteria. And different species do better on one side of your tooth than the other. And the same thing goes, say, for example, for your hand. I mean, the bacteria that are on your fingertips versus on your palm versus on the back of your hand, they're different. And they're adapted to these different kinds of temperatures and pH levels and all the rest.
How common are fecal transplants now?
Fecal transplants are still pretty much under the radar. There have been, I believe, a few hundred of them tried out in various parts of the world. There's no kind of official way to do them. I mean, basically, doctors do them when other things have failed. But there have been some published reviews where scientists have looked at case reports, and they find that they're quite effective, something like 90, 95% effective. The problem is, as some other journalists have reported, is that the FDA has a very difficult time figuring out how to come up with regulations for this. And so before it's going to become a very widespread, standardized kind of practice, the FDA is going to have to move beyond its old paradigm of just giving people kind of regular drugs to being able to give people sort of tailored concoctions of living things, of bacteria, maybe even viruses, as medical treatments.
Well, Carl Zimmer, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
No, thank you for having me.
Carl Zimmer spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Zimmer's article on antiviral drugs is in the current edition of Wired. You'll find a link on our website, freshair.npr.org. Zimmer's book, A Planet of Viruses, will be published in paperback later this month. Coming up, the great Dutch jazz drummer Han Bennink plays a drum and some other stuff sitting around our studio. This is Fresh Air. My guest is one of the best living jazz drummers in the world, but he's not that well known in the U.S. because he's Dutch. That drummer is Han Bennink, and today is his 70th birthday. He's one of the musicians our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead wrote about in his book New Dutch Swing. Kevin says that Bennink embodies all the traits of Dutch improvised music, often theatrical, humorous, and ironic, with killer chops that make the horsing around possible, and virtuosity that assures any mistake is deliberate. In 1967, Bennink co-founded the Dutch band the ICP Orchestra. ICP stands for Instant Composers Pool. They're still performing and recording. Here's Bennink with the ICP Orchestra on their 2010 recording, ICP-049. It shows how this band, known for free improvisation, can really swing. Thank you. Benink loves parade drumming, and you can hear that on this track from the recent album of duets Two for Two, featuring Benink and pianist Aki Takase. When Han Benink was getting started, he used to play with American jazz musicians on tour in Holland, including Sonny Rollins, Ben Webster, and Eric Dolphy. Benink is featured on Dolphy's live album Last Date, which was recorded in June 1964, just a few weeks before Dolphy died. Here's the track, Miss Anne. I spoke with drummer Han Benink earlier this year when he was in the U.S. to perform in several cities. As you'll soon hear, he not only plays drums, he'll use his sticks on anything that makes an interesting noise. Han Benink, welcome to Fresh Air. Han, I want to talk with you a little bit about your music life. When you started playing in the 60s.
Yes.
And
but that was all aping, of course. We wanted to sound. I wanted to sound like Kenny Clarke, and the bass player wanted to sound like Ray Brown. Those people were our favorite rhythm section.
Now, a lot of Americans felt like, well, European jazz doesn't really count as jazz because, one, they're European, they're not American. Two, they're not African American. And three, they can't possibly swing because they're European.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Did any of that bother you at any point in your career?
No, not at all. Because I was aping Kenny Clarke, for example, when I played with Joni Griffin or Babs Gonzalez or Ben Webster or Ben lived in Amsterdam, like Don Baez. So there were great players to play with. The bass player and me were always happy that when it was really coming together, and he said, wow, finally we sound like an American rhythm section. I'm not interested to sound like an American rhythm section at all anymore. I realize more and more that you have to report from your cultural background and do it with that.
So
don't ape.
One of the things I love about your drumming is that You hear sonic possibilities in so many things beyond the drums, and you're able to integrate that into your performances. So you're generous enough to bring a snare drum with you today. But before we knew for sure if you'd be able to bring a drum, Roberta, our director, and I just rounded up some random stuff from our offices. And now we're going to call it Found Objects and ask you if you can find some interesting sonic things about them. So just sitting on the table here, we have a bag of like paper clips. Yep. A metal book stand.
It's all fantastic. I like it.
Okay.
It's cool.
We got a box. Is that a box?
Oh, yeah.
With some junk in it. Yep.
razor knives in it.
It's a very old tin box.
And then Urban Outfitters.
Oh, it's a box that some clothing should
then
be
then we
in.
Have like
a glass with pens.
Glass, yeah. And then I don't know. Yeah,
this is like a little jelly bean holder, like okay. a coin thing
that
you put in the penny.
It's fine.
And then finally, that's a mic stand kind of thing. Okay. So that's our sonic possibilities here.
Yeah.
Do you think you could do something interesting with that?
Interesting, I can't give you any guarantee about that. But the thing of playing on everything comes actually a bit of a story. I used to play with my father in a band for the army. I never was a soldier, but I played. Of course, I wanted to play as much drums as I could in commercial bands. And we had to play for our soldiers. And then I was the youngest in the band, 17. We played in a tent, and the heat in the tent was so high that all the drum heads were broken when I had to play. And I was crying to my daddy because my dad and me were a sort of imitation Gene Krupa and Benny Goodman at the end of the show. And then my father said, come on, man, think about it. You just simply sit on the floor and you play on there and you do what you can. And that was such a wise lesson, sit on the floor and play. And I had much more success than I was playing on the drums anyway.
So you sat on the floor and you played the floor.
Yeah, right.
All right. So, you want to?
Okay. How long you want me to go?
A minute or two.
Okay. Then.
Whistling, very nice.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, love whistling.
It's nice to whistle. I when I play snare drum, I very much whistle like. Wie is Loesje? Loesje is het snoesje. Loesje is het snoesje van de drummer van de band. Ja, dat Loesje, met dat leuke bloesje. Loesje is de drummer van de band. Geef zij dan een break, wordt helemaal bleek.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that.
And
that's drummer Han Benning playing our studio table and a glass. And then before that, he was playing all kinds of other objects that we'd gathered from our office and laid before him, including a bag of paper clips. It was looking a little dangerous for a while. Things were like flying all over. One thing almost hit you in the face.
I'm sorry about that.
Dangerous business.
I know. Once when I was playing with very cheap drumsticks. Even George Lewis was in the band, was in Florence, Firenze. My drumstick broke off by the first hit, and it hit a lady in the eye. And it was ow! Just sitting like that. And it happened to be that the glass of her spectacles broke, but thank God she had nothing in her eye, because you don't want to go to a concert and come with one eye out of the concert, right? But it's sometimes very dangerous, yeah.
Have you ever hurt yourself?
Oh, many, many times.
How?
fingers, thumb, or bleeding.
You got a Band-Aid on now.
Yeah, look. It's like,
oh, wow. Like one thumb's got a really big knob on it. Yeah.
Stuff like that.
It kills me because I think like you are, you know, not that I know all living drummers, but you've got to be among like the best living drummers. And there's so many Americans who don't know your work because you're Dutch. You come here occasionally on tour. But I think it's mostly people who follow avant-garde jazz who really know your work. So I'm hoping more people will.
I hope so, too.
My guest is Dutch drummer Han Bennink. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dutch jazz drummer Han Bennink, a central figure in the Dutch jazz scene, not to mention one of the greatest jazz drummers in the world. He co-founded the Dutch band, the ICP Orchestra. Now, one of the things I hear in your playing, not so much in what you've been improvising, but on some of your recordings, is a love of marches, parade music, circus music.
Absolute.
Can you talk a little bit about your interest in that and the kind of rhythms that come
of
out
course,
of that you like to play.
Yeah.
And you could demonstrate here if you'd like.
Well, the first time, I remember when the Second World War was over, I was born in 1942, that they were dropping these big tins with Swedish white bread in it. And when you empty them, you had a big tin, and you make a string around your neck, and you play like marching bands. And my father was a drummer, so automatically that was the thing. When there was a parade coming to Zaandam at that particular time after the Second World War, of course you were marching like a child behind it. It gave me an incredible feeling. And that same feel I have is African music, African drumming. Not that I don't want to ape it, but there's a certain direction, a certain goal. Well, I give you a little bit of a demonstration.
Drummers marching into the distance.
Right.
That was great. And that was Han Bennink just playing our table with a little towel over the table top. I love those marching bands parade music and stuff. It's just so stirring.
Like Mardi Gras.
Exactly.
Same stuff.
Exactly.
And it's the beginning of jazz also. It's a shame that actually in America they are doing actually nothing for jazz. It's the national heritage. Hello. But hello, you have jazz music. This would give much more money for that.
Any comparison between audiences in America and Holland?
Now, of course it depends of the concert and what you did on the concert. But I must say that my favorite audience is the American audience. So the American audience for me is the best audience in the world. And of course, the question is then why? Well, you see, I've been playing, and there were people who brought their kids, and the kids were 4 years old. But at the same time, there were people who were probably 94 years old. So my whole audience is, our audience was 90 years old, that thing. And I think that is amazing. And if they like it, they really go for it.
Han Benink recorded in our studio earlier this year during an American tour. Today is his 70th birthday. You can watch two videos of him playing drums in our studio on our website, freshair.npr.org. He has two concerts in New York this month. On April 18th, he'll perform with the accordion player Will Holzhauser and clarinetist and saxophone player Michael Moore. We'll close with a new recording by that trio called Live in New York. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Roberta Shurrock, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, supporting coverage of workers' issues. More information at publicwelfare.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Matt Apuzzo, part of the Associated Press's investigative team that just won a Pulitzer Prize for revealing the New York Police Department's clandestine spying program that monitored daily life in Muslim communities. Join us.